Good morning, Council. I'm not sure if you were present for the announcement at the beginning of the calendar, but Judge Bentley is unable to be present, but she will listen to the oral argument and participate in the case conference and decision-making, pursuant to our normal practice. We are ready for arguments in this case. Who is our representing appellant this morning?
Andrew Letourneau, Your Honor, on behalf of the appellant, State of Minnesota.
All right, and who is representing a respondent?
Who do you want, Eric Newmark, N-E-W-M-A-R-K, Mr. Gutierrez.
And could you pronounce Gutierrez?
That was it.
Gutierrez. All right, then we are ready for argument from counsel for the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Andrew Letourneau, Letourneau. I'm representing the appellant, State of Minnesota, on behalf of the Olmsted County Attorney's Office. We are here on a case in which the state convicted Isaac Gutierrez of unintentional second-degree felony murder. That case involved an altercation in a parking lot at a Chick-fil-A in Rochester, Minnesota, that ended up with the occupants of both vehicles, occupied by Isaac Gutierrez and his brother, Jose Ojeda, and the other vehicle occupied by the victim, in this case, Osbel Ornelius, his friend, and some family members. The altercation escalated from arguing to a fist fight between Osbel Ornelius and Jose Ojeda. Jose Ojeda brandished a firearm, was convinced to put the firearm away, so he put it back in his vehicle, went back to the scene where Osbel Ornelius was, and began a fist fight. At some point here, the defendant, respondent, Isaac Gutierrez, grabbed the gun out of the vehicle, inserted himself in the fight, attempted to, as the jury found, pistol whip Mr. Ornelius, and ended up firing that weapon and shooting him in the head, leading to his death.
Counsel, can I just jump in with some questions?
Yes.
You're familiar with the facts of the case. Why is it that you believe the district court erred in granting a downward durational departure? What reasons did the district court give, and why do you think those reasons were impermissible?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The state believes that the district court abused its discretion because in order to downward durationally depart, the court must find substantial and compelling factors and that make the defendant's conduct significantly less serious than your typical second-degree unintentional felony murder. The state appellant believes that the reasons given by the district court conflate the factors, offender-specific factors, as opposed to offense-specific factors, and also that other findings that the district court makes that supported the decision to durationally depart are inconsistent with the facts in the record and against what the law states should be considered.
What offender-specific factors did the district court err by considering?
In the sentencing transcript, the court can see that there are an outline of different things that the court did consider. Those were a lack of intent. That is considered by the guidelines, so that should not be considered.
Why can't the district court consider that in determining whether this is less onerous than a typical crime? I mean, I'll just be honest. What I'm trying to wrap my head around is you can't consider the elements of the crime, but in deciding whether or not something is less onerous, you have to look at the elements of the crime. You have to say, are these elements of the crime less serious in this case than a different case? And so I'm struggling with in what you would like a district court to do differently in terms of evaluating whether an offense is less onerous, other than considering things like how did the situation start, which you say, well, it's unintentional. We can't consider whether it's unintentional, but why can't a district court consider a factor like that when deciding this crime was less onerous than a different crime?
I understand that, but in order to consider that to be less onerous, you're also finding a way to lessen the sentence. By finding the crime less onerous to depart downward, you're finding a way to lessen the sentence. The sentencing guidelines have already taken into account intent when setting the guidelines, and it made unintentional murder SL-10 instead of intentional murder, which is an SL-11. So it really cut the presumptive down.
But when I look at the district court's findings with regard to intent, I think the district court is talking about intent, what his intent was when he entered this situation, not his intent at the time he hit him with the gun. The district court is saying in a lot of unintentional murder cases, the person enters the situation, the entire altercation with some kind of criminal intent. They're entering a person's house with a gun. They, in fact, are the ones holding the gun. And in this case, we have a defendant who wanted to get a sandwich at Chick-fil-A. And I guess I'm not understanding why that sort of intent in entering the situation can't be considered when deciding whether or not this crime is less onerous.
I don't think the district court did, I believe, find that he didn't intend to kill the victim when he approached the situation. I think it's very clear that he did intend to commit assault in the second degree when he grabbed the gun, approached the conflict, and struck Mr. Ornelius. So, again, I believe that his intent...
But when I read the district court's order, that's not the way that it's weighing the intent. I think that the district court here, you know, looked at a lot of cases. I mean, I personally, and I haven't been on the bench particularly long, but I don't know that I've seen a case where the district court did this thorough of research in terms of reading every case since 2001 regarding the offense and then trying to figure out where this particular fact circumstance fit into the more or less onerous spectrum. And I guess I don't know what other factors you would want the district court to consider when that's what they have to do in order to evaluate whether to grant this departure.
Right, and it's the appellant's position that considering intent is very clearly not allowed by the case law here. I can cite to...
The case law provides if a factor is already an element of the crime, it can't be considered as a departure factor.
Correct. Other things
should
that
we be looking at his intent when he decided to go to Chick-fil-A for a sandwich or his intent when he decided to take the gun that his brother had returned to the car and decided not to involve in the ruckus and went over to pistol whip someone?
His intent of going to Chick-fil-A isn't part of the offense in this matter. If you go to the elements, what he was doing on his way to the parking lot doesn't affect whether or not affect the elements of this offense. His intent when he was grabbing the gun, inserting himself in the situation, and then assaulting Mr. Ornelius is part of
what case
elements.
Law do you have to support that when a district court is evaluating whether this circumstance is less onerous, that the district court cannot consider what led up to the incident?
Oh, Your Honor, I will.
In evaluating whether this is a less onerous offense.
Right. I'm not saying that the district court can't. I know there is case law that says considering what was happening leading up to the event can be considered. And it was by the court here. It was mentioned during the sentencing hearing. I think it's most important to focus on the elements of the offense and the intent there, what makes this crime less onerous than your typical second-degree murder.
So really you just disagree with the district court's analysis? I mean, I'm having trouble if you only need one factor, and I think that you agree that the district court found that this offense was less onerous, that that's the finding of the district court, then why isn't your argument just that you would have reached a different conclusion based on the facts in this case?
Well, I think the district court's finding that if you were to take the, as we're talking about what he was doing beforehand, just going to get Chick-fil-A for a sandwich, that factor alone, it would go against logic to grant a durational departure looking at that
factor.
But
that's not the only thing the district court considered. The district court considered that the defendant was a passenger, considered the fact that the victim had, in fact, sort of started the whole situation because the victim wouldn't wait 30 seconds for the parking to happen. The district court took into account that he stayed at the scene. He didn't run away. He accepted responsibility. I mean, the district court was taking into account a lot of things, and I get that some of those are offense-related and some of those are offender-related, but it's not just, and this is where I'm struggling, it's not just this sort of can you consider intent or not consider intent. I think the district court was obviously considering a lot of things and evaluating whether this particular situation was less onerous than a typical situation.
Counsel, could you address for the court the notion that we reviewed two things. One, whether or not there should have been any durational departure, and two, the length of the departure.
Yes, Your Honor.
In other words, the district court abused its discretion in going from the presumptive sentence down to 60 months.
Would you like me to address both of those?
Right.
Okay. So the appellant state is arguing that the departure should never have been granted in the first place because all of the reasons that the district court gave, lack of intent, taking responsibility, the defendant playing a minor or passive role, victim being the aggressor, and the offense itself generally was less onerous. The state's position is we're conflating offender-based factors and offense-based factors, and we're also the findings that the victim being the aggressor and the offense was generally less onerous are against logic and against the facts in the record.
I understood. So as to the second point, what do we do with the notion that we are to review the length of the departure that was given? What is the law in that area?
Well, Your Honor, the state believes that what the court basically did was reduce the amount of sentence to that of what would be more of a second-degree assault or that of a criminal vehicular homicide kind of situation. I know respondent argued that this should be considered more like a criminal vehicular or homicide because there wasn't the intention to actually kill. However,
is there any case law? I mean, I know we have case law addressing how you review an upward durational departure. Is there any case law telling us how we review a downward durational departure? In other words, if a court were to conclude, I think there was a basis to do a downward departure here. Next question is, was this the right number? How are we to assess that, and are we to assess that?
I'm not aware of any case law off the top of my head that addresses, that gives you an equation as to what the reduction is appropriate in certain circumstances.
Have you found a single case where we've reversed a downward based on the number?
If it's not in the brief, I haven't seen it. However, it's the state's position that all of the factors that the court considered are already taken into account by the legislature setting of that severity level 10 instead of a severity level 11.
You have anything further at this point, or we'll save it for rebuttal?
Could I ask one question about the victim as the aggressor? And I this is more of a question. I know in the context of, self-defense claims, for example, where the element is whether or not the person was the aggressor, we do have a series of cases where the defendant who's claiming self-defense sort of, you know, started the situation with something that didn't seem like it was going to escalate as extremely as it did. But we found that nonetheless they were the aggressor. I think of, for example, the Chelberg case where the defendant told the victim that his car was on his property and he was not allowed on his property and he couldn't get into his car. The victim then escalated the situation into an assault, and ultimately the defendant killed the victim. And at our court, the argument was, well, he wasn't the aggressor. All he did was say, you can't come on my property, and he was legally entitled to say that. And I believe that what our court said was, no, he's the initial aggressor, because rather than just letting the victim take the car, he sort of started the whole series of events. And I'm just wondering how that set of case law intersects with sort of the thinking about the victim as the aggressor in this context, whether that has any application, whether they're totally different standards or not.
Well, I believe it's rather unclear as to exactly who said what immediately as this conflict was starting. I think there's evidence in the record that Mr. Ojeda was the first one out of a vehicle. There's evidence in the record that Mr. Ojeda was the first one to brandish a firearm.
Sure, but isn't the evidence in the record that Mr. Ojeda was parking the car and the victim is the one who got upset at the fact that he was being slowed down? That's my understanding of the record, and I didn't know that that was in dispute.
If my memory is correct, I don't think that there was concrete fact that that is exactly what happened. I think there might have been conflicting testimony about exactly what happened at the very beginning. So to say that the victim was the aggressor just doesn't fit with the facts. And logically, when you have Mr. Ojeda throwing the first punch, introducing the firearm, putting the firearm away, and then Mr. Gutierrez reintroducing the firearm and using it as a weapon. So it really doesn't make sense that the victim is the aggressor here.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you.
Could you be sure to state your name for the record before you begin, counsel? Take the time you need with the podium.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Newmark, N-E-W-M-A-R-K, and I'm counsel for the respondent, Isaac Gutierrez. Judge Larson stole a little bit of my thunder with her preliminary questioning here relating to intent, and I think we need to take a step back. The state essentially is trying to say that any time the district court used the word intent, she was referring to an element of the offense, specifically the original charge of intentional murder. But really what the district court was doing was looking at the overall situation. When she was using the word intent, she was talking not about specifically an intent to kill. She was talking about the general situation, what were these parties doing leading up to? And I think for the state to, you know, sort of hammer that one word and try to make it sound like what the district court here did was impermissibly use an element of the offense, or in this case, a lack of element of the offense, to support the departure, it just doesn't fit what happened here. So what did happen here? The district court, first of all, it should be noted that this was a trial. The district court did not just have the benefit of a plea agreement, a short statement by the defendant admitting facts, and sentencing. The district court had the opportunity to fully observe the entire circumstances here, all of the witnesses, including the testimony of Mr. Gutierrez, who did testify. And it's important to note that on several occasions in her findings, the district court found Mr. Gutierrez's testimony to be credible.
Okay. Counsel, just because I do have some questions that go to the merits, and we're quite familiar with the order and the record. When reviewing the length of a departure, it's my understanding that this court is to require on its collective knowledge as a bench and compare the sentence imposed to others that are normally imposed for this offense in determining whether it was an appropriate amount of departure, assuming that a departure was permissible.
All right.
So let's assume that there were grounds to depart here. I would like to talk about the length of the departure and how we deal with that. In terms of collective knowledge of the bench, I was a PD for 13 years in Minneapolis, district court judge for 3 years, and court of appeals judge for 17 years. I can't ever recall seeing a downward departure of this amount. As I understand it, this is less than 50% of the low end of the box for the presumptive sentence. So it's a pretty significant departure. When we are looking at a double upward departure, a pretty significant departure the other way, there's a pretty tough standard to meet to justify that length of departure. I'm not aware of any case law saying, well, that same rule should apply when you go down. But if we're going down this low, less than half of the low end of the box, shouldn't we be, you know, really scrutinizing that sentence if, you know, among us, we can't think of a case in our history of judges that is comparable to this departure length?
And I anticipated questions along those lines. And the court is correct that when we talk about upward departure, generally, and it's somewhat recent case law, but generally, double departure is within the sound discretion of the trial court. Anything beyond that requires a little more scrutiny.
So double is okay on its own? I thought there was a specific standard. To get to a double, you had to show X. I could be wrong.
I think it's up to double is generally okay, and then anything beyond a double departure. That's my recollection. I didn't put it in my brief, but my recollection is that generally speaking, a double departure. And here we've got slightly more than a double departure in reverse, essentially. The low end of the range was 128, so 4 more months would have been essentially.
And what do you need to show to justify more than a double upward?
Well, I still think it's within the sound discretion of the trial court to determine the length of the departure, and there is no similar case law on downward departures.
Okay, but for the case law involving more than a double upward departure, what have we said we're looking for to justify that, or what must the district court find to justify that?
I think that it's just got to be an extremely unusual set of facts justifying that the offense conduct was so significant, there were so many aggravating factors, or one aggravating factor that was so severe that justified the double departure. And that hasn't always been the case in Minnesota. That certainly since I've been practicing, that was a new rule.
Okay,
it's not a statutory rule or guidelines rule. It's case law.
It's case law. Did you happen to pull any reports from sentencing guidelines, just like, generally speaking, here's the universe of cases in which someone was charged with unintentional felony murder and was given a downward durational departure. Here's kind of where the sentences fall.
I did not. I know that the district court did pull some of those cases. She didn't specifically say generally what the departure was. But this judge...
But I want to make sure I understand. I think as I'm recalling it, the judge discussed some cases and said, well, this is what normally happens in a felony murder situation. This case is not that bad. Okay, let's assume that's true.
Yep.
Then the next question is, well, what is an appropriate sentence given that this case is not that bad? I think the case law says we look at similar cases. So we'd look for a felony murder case where there is a downward durational departure, and we'd say, well, generally speaking, what are people getting for a sentence in those cases to make sure we're maintaining some consistency, similar offense, similarly situated defendant. They're supposed to get similar sentences. We can't have, you know, judges saying, well, I'm going to give you 20 months, I'm going to give you 60 months, well, it's 128, I'm going to give you 115. We need to have consistency. So what do we know about sentencing in the state of Minnesota that tells us going less than half on a downward durational departure on a felony murder is sort of the norm here?
Well, and I don't think it needs to be the norm for it to be for this court to uphold the sentence and affirm the judge's decision, because these are all case by case and fact specific.
Yes,
cases.
But we're a sentencing guidelines state, and the whole point of the sentencing guidelines is to ensure similar sentences for similarly situated offenders, which is the reason we have the guidelines. Now, if we're going to step outside the guidelines and say, well, now we're in departure range, should we not have the same sort of departure for similarly situated defendants? And would we then not look at other departure cases to see what people are generally getting on a departure durationally downward in a felony murder case?
Right. I understand the court's question, and the purpose of the guidelines and the purpose of the presumptive sentence is exactly that, so that we are consistent with sentencing among racial parties, North and South Minnesota, rural and urban. There is not a similar, at least as my understanding, mission statement or anything like that in the guidelines that say once departure grounds, whether upward or downward, exist, we then have to find similar cases and peg this sentence along those lines. We give discretion to the district court.
But doesn't the case law say we look at, you know, collective knowledge of the lengths of sentences generally imposed and, you know, short of pulling reports from Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we'd look at all cases, precedential and non-precedential, just to see what people are getting.
And that might be true, but I would submit that generally, this is an unusual case for a lot of reasons, but the most important one is that this was a trial. Almost always when there's a departure, at least a downward departure, it's the result either of a plea agreement or of a guilty plea. But here we've got...
So is it your position that as long as we conclude the judge was within her discretion to give a downward durational departure on the facts of this case, she gets to pick whatever number she wants, and it's beyond review?
I'm not saying it's beyond review. It's still abuse of discretion.
18 months. Well, how do we review the exercise of discretion used to decide on 60 months in this case?
Well, I think we give deference to the finder of fact, or not really the finder of fact, but in this case, the judge who heard the testimony, and also you're correct. It's sort of the collective experience of the appellate court, but also the experience of the district court. And this is a very experienced district court trial judge who had a lot of extensive background doing criminal justice system in the trial court level. And so I do agree that it's not unfettered discretion. It is abuse of discretion. But we're not talking about a sentence here where this individual was given, as the court says, 18 months or a year and a day. The sentence that was given here, judges, is more severe than a criminal vehicular operation, for example. And that's an argument that I made at the district court, that the conduct here was more akin to that sort of level of intent, level of conduct, where a person is doing something dangerous, drinking and driving, and happens to cause a terrible result. The presumptive sentence there is 48 months. So I think we don't need to just look at...
And so why, based on that, isn't there evidence in the record to say the district court bought your argument that this was sort of a lower level intent, like vehicular operation, and she didn't think 48 was appropriate, but she thought that 60 was, something closer to 48 made sense, and that argument was made to her, and she was persuaded by it, and it was within her discretion to make that decision.
Why did she specifically adopt
that? I guess I'm asking, why isn't that the appropriate analysis in this case?
Why isn't that I guess what I'm trying to say is, when we're looking at the universe of sentences here, I don't think we need to limit ourselves to just this specific offense. In other words, can we find another felony murder, unintentional murder, where a sentence of 60 months was given? Were the facts in that case more serious or less serious? I think we can look at other similar cases which are not identical in terms of the charged offense, but similar in conduct. And the reason why I made that analogy is because I do believe it's similar to a person who gets behind the wheel intoxicated. That's a dangerous thing to do, can cause a bad result. And I think the behavior... It's an illegal thing to do. As the jury found, what my client did was an illegal thing to do, which was to use a gun as a weapon to strike, exceeding the permissible self-defense or defense of others.
And there was a mandatory minimum sentence of 60 months for this offense because
no.
of the use of... There wasn't?
This was not charged as a 60911. In my recollection, it wasn't charged 60911 with a mandatory 60 months.
Is that even an option? I thought there is a mandatory minimum sentence if a dangerous weapon is used in an offense, and if the dangerous weapon is a firearm, it's 60 months.
It needs to be charged that way. And I don't recall that there was a specific 60911 is a statute that, and in any case, because of his lack of record, that would be waivable anyway. The court, on its own motion or on the motion of the defense, can waive the mandatory minimum. But the judge, I don't believe the judge was sentencing a mandatory minimum here. She certainly didn't mention that, and it wasn't argued by either side that this was a 60911 mandatory minimum case. But just sort of to get back to your question, Judge Larson and Judge Larkin, the abuse of discretion standard applies to both whether there's grounds for departure, and I think we're kind of past that argument, but I can certainly address it more if the court wants to. But in terms of the length of the departure, I don't think there certainly is not any case law that says more than 50% departure gets a different level of scrutiny than just the abuse of discretion standard. But I do think it's helpful to look at the guidelines for other types of cases involving a death that wasn't intentional to determine whether the facts of this case are more similar to the facts of that case. And that's why I made that argument at the district court, and I think that's why the argument...
But then you are going to the element of intent if you do it that way, aren't you? If you're saying, well, we should pick the sentence based on other non-intentional offenses...
Well, this was a non-intentional offense.
Okay, so that you're drawing that similarity.
Right. What I'm saying is because this is a non-intentional offense... We can't say his lack of intent is a basis to depart, and no one said that. The district court didn't say that either. But what I am saying is we can be informed by similar guidelines cases that are lack of intent to cause a death, but that caused a death.
Did the district court cite any? Like I said, I know she cited. I've reviewed all these cases going back this long. Here are the facts that are normally involved in those cases. So this doesn't look as onerous. Did the district court do the same sort of case review in terms of, and determining what the amount should be.
Not that I'm aware of. And the district court is not required by this court to make that analysis. The court's not required to go back and look at individual cases and say, ours is less serious, that person got 90 months. This one, ours is more serious, that person got 45 months. There's no requirement that the court do that or even explain why this was a less serious offense. But this was, the court made the finding that this was less onerous, and it was significantly less onerous.
I understand you mean that finding. Then yeah. What did the court say about why 60 months was justified as opposed to 80, as opposed to 100?
There wasn't a specific
reason.
So
there's no explanation.
She simply just said that she balanced all of the factors. She balanced...
How are we to review a decision for abuse of discretion if the decision isn't explained?
Well, the decision to depart was explained.
I understand the decision right. to depart was explained. Was an explanation provided as to why the judge selected 60 months as opposed to another number?
The judge didn't say I could have selected 90 because of State v. Blank and I didn't because that one was more serious. No.
Did the judge say I selected 60 because? Other than saying
no.
I balanced all the factors
no.
and I picked 60.
No, and I don't think there's certainly not a requirement that the judge
pick it. It's not a requirement, but a judge's discretionary decision is difficult to review if there's no explanation. Why would we not send this back and say we would like you to explain to everybody why you picked 60 months so it can be reviewed by the appellate court?
I'm aware of no case law, Judge, that says that a judge is specifically required not only to find and explain departure grounds, which of course they are and there needs to be a departure report, but I'm aware of no cases that then say when you pick the number, you need to explain again why that number was selected as opposed to any other number.
And if that's not a requirement, what do we do when the judge in the next case says I'm given 12 months on the murder?
Well, again, the standard is abuse of discretion. There's not unfettered discretion. And so the court can look at, you know, it, as the court pointed out before, the collective knowledge of the bench to say, does this sentence, generally speaking, fit the facts of this case? And that's why...
Or do we say, is this sentence consistent with other sentences given in departure cases for this offense, which would be entirely consistent with the complete underpinnings of our sentencing guidelines system. I mean, our system, we compare apples to apples. So it makes perfect sense to me, even though it may not be specifically set forth in the guidelines or case law, and perhaps this is the first case that says it, that given the reasons for our sentencing guidelines system and Minnesota's commitment to that system to ensure that similarly treated offenders are treated similarly, it is only reasonable to require a district court judge to choose a departure amount that is consistent with other departure cases that are similar.
Well, I'm not aware of any case that's ever required that for an upward departure, and we routinely get upward departures where they simply say, The presumptive sentence is 60, here's 120. And I'm not aware of any appellate court that then gives more scrutiny to that, so I'm not sure why we would give more scrutiny when we're departing the other grounds, even though obviously much more common for large upward departures than there are for large.
True
like
enough, but all we have is if you go more than double, it needs to be really extenuating
right.
circumstances. So we would have
right.
to look at this and say, well, this is less than half, so is it a really extenuating circumstance?
And it's 4 months less than if the court had imposed, by my math, and I was absent the day they taught math at school, but I believe 64 would be half of the low end of the range. So we're not talking a significant departure beyond 50%. And again, there is no case law from this court or the Supreme Court indicating that there's some lower boundary.
Let me ask this if you're comparing to other cases. If he had just been charged with second-degree assault, 609-11, we're not charging him with murder. He got out of the car and he pistol-whipped somebody.
Yeah.
The presumptive sentence would be 60 months, mandatory minimum.
If it was charged...
As a second-degree assault.
Actually, 36 months is the mandatory minimum on assault, too, not 60.
Well, unless a dangerous weapon was used and it's charged as a 609-11.
With a firearm, it's 36. 36 months is the mandatory minimum.
Okay.
60 months is a mandatory minimum on a felon in possession, but 36 months with an assault if it's a gun, I think it's a year. If it's a knife, it's a year and a day.
A day or 36.
Because in fact, I think second degree assault is a presumptive state sentence.
But absent
the legislature putting the mandatory minimums in. So that would be, it would be a 36-month sentence if he had simply brandished the weapon and pointed it, let alone struck him with it. Either way, 36-month sentence, which obviously is a shorter sentence than the judge imposed here.
Should we look at purposes of sentencing as set forth in the guidelines, which, you know, include retribution, making the victim whole, all of those other things?
Well, certainly that's relevant in the abuse of discretion review, and the court did that. The court made a lot of efforts. I mean, this is a judge who not only heard the arguments of counsel and the victim impact statements and the statement of my client, but then took a break of several weeks. This is how serious this judge was in making this right decision. Took it upon herself without any requirement to do an exhaustive review of all of these cases that's not required to come up with what she believed in her exercise of discretion was the correct sentence. There really is no basis for this court on the abuse of discretion standard to second guess and reverse the well-reasoned and well-thought-out decision of the trial court.
Seems like that's a good place to end.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your arguments. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Andrew Letourneau again on behalf of this appellant. I want to start with the talk of the 60911. This case was charged as a 60911 subdivision 5A for the use of a dangerous weapon, which made the mandatory minimum of 36 months.
Okay.
So I think that 60911 subdivision 5A inherently makes this crime more onerous than your typical murder in the second degree unintentional, because the legislature has found that if you use a firearm or a dangerous weapon, that it enhances and in some way should require some minimum amount of prison time. This,
although he got 60 months as opposed to 36.
If he was ineligible to possess a firearm.
No, I'm saying he received more than the mandatory minimum.
Right.
The mandatory minimum was 36. He received 60.
Yes, and I'm not comparing the 60 that he got to the 36 that's required under that subdivision. I'm saying that in the analysis of whether this case is less onerous than other unintentional murders in the second degree, I think we kind of inherently find that it is, because the legislature has carved out this mandatory minimum in 60911. So I think that's a factor that really wasn't discussed by the district court at all. It wasn't considered, but I think it is an important factor to consider. There was also some discussion about the intent level of this offense being the same or similar to that of a criminal vehicular homicide case. I think that is patently untrue. Here, in a criminal vehicular homicide case, you have an intoxicated person intending to get in a vehicle and drive. In this case, we have a defendant who intentionally decided to grab a firearm, not care to check if it's loaded or unloaded, insert himself in a conflict he wasn't previously involved with, have his finger not only on the outside of the trigger casing, but on the trigger itself. There's evidence in the record that in order for that gun to fire, your trigger has got to be on, your finger has to be on the trigger, and the trigger has to be pulled with 5 pounds of pressure. So he intentionally approached Mr. Ornelius, intentionally assaulted him with the firearm, with his finger on the trigger, and then pulled it, with the gun barrel facing his head. I think there's a lot more intent involved in that kind of offense than there is with somebody deciding to get in their vehicle and drive under the influence.
What is the presumptive sentence for a reckless homicide? Because it sounds like reckless conduct. So that would be third degree.
I don't know off the top of my head. So I
have a question with regard to the length. I mean, you know, this is sort of the unusual case where the state is the appellant. Do you agree that it's your burden on appeal to show that the 60 months is not appropriate and that we needed to remand? Do you agree that that's your burden as the appellant?
We are asking this court to evaluate whether the district court made the correct findings in order to justify that length of departure. we see here
my question, Judge Larkin's question was to respondent about whether they had pulled sentencing reports to see whether this fits into the, but you agree that in this case you're the appellant, and in fact it would be your burden to come forth with that kind of evidence to show that this length was wrong, and that we should reverse. You agree that as the appellant that's your burden?
Yes, and I think our burden is met by the fact that the district court didn't explain at all the reasons behind the length for the departure.
But, like respondent said, that's really typical, right? I mean, normally you're on the other side, and this is an upward, where the district court is like, I find three aggravating factors, and therefore I give a double departure without any further explanation as to why the double as opposed to somewhere else in the spectrum is different. And you'd be saying the same thing respondent is saying here, which is the case law doesn't require the district court to provide any further explanation.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. The reviewing court does have the authority to modify a departure of a sentence and impose if the length of the sentence imposed by the district court was inappropriate. It's almost impossible for this court to find that the departure being double or more than double less than what it should be was appropriate, because there's nothing in the record for the district court to have justified that.
So you would agree that that would be the same for a double upward then? We now should be requiring district courts, if they want to do a double, that they need to have done a case survey to figure out whether these particular facts fit into other doubles, and they need to do all of that research to fit where this spectrum of conduct fits before they can do a double upward, right? I mean, what's good for the goose has to be good for the gander, right?
I do believe that there should be some kind of justification if there's going to be such a egregious departure either way. In this case, we don't have that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments, gentlemen. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you.